You want some bad news, Michael?
No.
What are you asking me?
You're the guru of the gray matter. I figured if anybody had it, you'd have the answer.
I can't give you any direction.
I think I'm going to have to change this channel. I'm sorry.
You're completely wrong.
I refuse to be wrong on two calls in a row.
Tell me I'm spot on or tell me I'm crazy as I'll get out.
I have no idea.
I have a six-month-old, so we'll be raising him according to Dr. Ray.
Talk about being a winner.
So, you want my question?
You ain't making any sense.
You're absolutely right. I just needed confirmation.
So what are you going to do about it, Dawn?
I'm calling you.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Poor Dawn. Relegated to calling me. Solve that situation. Dawn, what if I wasn't on the air? What would you do then? What if it's a weekend, Dawn, and I'm not around? What if it's E-Person Monday? But fortunately, I'm here now, Dawn, if you want to call in. 877-57-EQUAL is the number. I am sitting in the library on the campus of Ave Maria University in Florida, about a half hour from Naples, as I understand it. Spectacularly warm, welcoming, beautiful town, very heavy, heavy Catholic influence everywhere. Last night we did two TV programs, Living Right with Dr. Ray here. They forced the students to come. Yeah, they gave them extra credit, probably paid them, gave them pizzas, whatever, but we had a half an audience full of students, and they were definitely responsive. I asked them, I said, how many of you would not have come, and I set up the audience beforehand because I knew what they were supposed to do. I said, how many of you would not have come if you weren't given extra credit or if you weren't required as some kind of community service? And pretty much everybody raised their hands. I said, well, look, I'm not going to force you to stay here. You don't want to be here. I'm not groveling for an audience. Go. So they all got up. I said, wait. Okay. I am groveling for an audience. Just see if you can stay another hour or so, just, and I'll pay you. But we had it all set up. So the kids were great. My guests were Mr. Tom Monahan. Tom Monahan founded this city and this university to the tune of, are you ready for these numbers? $500 million. As in million. And Mr. Monahan also gave a very hefty startup donation to Ave Maria Radio some 25 years ago to get it off the ground. Ave, who right now produces an awful lot of daytime programming that EWTN Catholic Network picks up. So Mr. Monahan had a hand in that too. And then we had the president of the university, Mr. Mark Middorf, who used to be with the Augustine Institute. And now he's here. Now, yesterday I mentioned that we're going to shoot a couple shows in the evening, and folks came and said they heard it on the radio and didn't know it, and they came. So I'll say it again. We're shooting two more shows tonight over, I believe, at I think it's at the Student Union. It's a very nice setting. If you want to come, you don't have to sign up now. Just show up. We've got seating for about 150. 5:30, 7:15 are the two shows. If you would like to join us in the audience, in my opinion, is an absolutely quintessential ingredient for the programs. So, 877-573-7825. If you have a question about something of life, or you want to give an insight, something you've learned, it's always be very helpful here. I shouldn't say. Is a terrible filler word, and I got to stop that. It's too easy to just say something when you should just pause. Just let silence happen until the next thing you're going to say. Instead, well, you know, like, perfect. All these filler words. People don't like silence. If you have a question about something particular to you, or if you have a question that is not particular to you, maybe it's particular to somebody else, or it's a generic question, something that you've wondered about, something you don't understand in psychology or development or IQ testing, or more esoteric topics like hypnosis. What else would be an esoteric topic that people are fascinated with? Sleep. Sleep is a fascinating part of our existence. You know, why is it that God designed us to be unconscious for 8 hours or more or less? It's kind of dangerous. If you're in a predatory world, why sleep like that? You know, the animals, they wake up real fast. Some of us, we have to get pounded to wake up, and then we're groggy for the next 6, 8, 10 minutes. Well, let me give you a number one more time before I go into my monologue. I want to hear from you. 877-573-7825. 877-57-equal. Eric, if you are texting me, I don't know if I'm going to get them. You may have to talk to me through my headsets at the breaks. Certainly want to hear from you folks. There are a lot of diagnoses in life that are promulgated, initiated by mental health types. You know, things like narcissism. Okay, Eric, I just got your text. Thank you. Things like narcissism. Narcissism has become just now the word du jour that we use to describe pretty much anybody that's difficult or unpleasant or self-centered. We just expanded the definition of narcissism. But if you look at the actual personality diagnosis of narcissism, it's pretty serious stuff. This is not somebody who is difficult and ugly with you, but six other people in his life love him. No, this is a person who has such a pervasive sense of locked-in self-centeredness that he can't function around people. I know you're thinking, I know people like that. I know people like that. Some of these diagnoses make popular lexicon, but they really aren't any kind of clinical label. Examples of this would be seven-year itch, or what would be another one? Well, how about the one I'm going to talk about today? Middle child syndrome, MCS. You know, initials can summarize a disorder that's arrived. You can just call it by its initials. Yeah, MCS. People know what you're talking about. If you don't have an odd number of children, you can't have middle child syndrome. Do the math. You have to have 3, 5, 7, 9, or 11. If you have 4, you don't have a middle child. You got an upper middle and a lower middle. I suppose it could trickle up or down. Want to stretch it. I always tell parents, you're afraid of middle child syndrome, don't have an odd number of kids. You know, have an odd number, give another one. Or give one away. I don't know. Now, I've often been fascinated by middle child syndrome. First of all, there's no such thing. Okay, let me underline that. There is no such thing. Dr. Ray, my middle child fits all of the descriptions of middle child syndrome. He has identity issues. He wonders where he fits in the family. He misbehaves to get attention. He's clearly the more difficult of my children. I don't doubt that. However, it's probably his temperament. It's who he is. He'd be that way if he was one or last or second middle from the end. I don't know. He'd be who he is. And one-third of the time, if you have 3 kids, one-third of the time your most difficult kid is going to be the middle kid. That's enough to keep a stereotype going. One-third? Oh, that's plenty more than you need to keep a stereotype going. We had 3 children at one point. My daughter Hannah was the middle child. It was Andrew, Hannah, then Sarah. Sarah was the baby. Andrew was the oldest. Hanny was the middle child. Well, thinking maybe Hanny's going to start manifesting some of these middle child things. Well, before she could, or before we noticed it, we adopted Sam. Now, that moved Hannah up to upper middle. And Sarah, who was the baby, and of course the baby is supposed to have certain characteristics. Well, she's not the baby anymore. Sammy's the baby. Sarah's lower middle. Well, now we don't have any middle children. Wait a minute. We adopted John and Joanna. twins. They were age four. So we jumped from four to six. Well, we still didn't have a middle child because John and Joanna, who were twins, now jumped into those middle spots, but they too were upper and lower middle. And Hannah, who not so long ago was a middle child, is now second oldest, right behind Andrew. Now, the only one who never changed positions was Andrew. He was the oldest. Everybody else was either a middle child, lower middle child, upper middle child, or baby. Until we got to Liz, who was number 10, and she remained the baby because she was the last child we adopted. So I got a question. Was Hanny middle child long enough to contract middle child syndrome? Did she initially have acute middle child syndrome and then it drifted into chronic middle child syndrome with residual effects from the, I think it was about a year that Hanny spent as a middle child? Is that enough to develop those characteristics? I think over the years of us adding to our family, we had four, maybe five, I'd have to do the math, middle children. They came and they went, and they came and they went, and they came and they went. Well, any of them there long enough to contract middle child syndrome? Some of you listening have two children right now, and you're hoping and praying that God's going to bless you with a third. Does this mean that your younger child right now has a latent middle child syndrome, you see? Because it's not manifesting itself until you have a third kid. Then this child moves into the middle spot, and therefore he can develop the condition of middle child syndrome. I had this theory that middle child syndrome gained popularity, I don't know how long ago it was, probably 30, 40 years ago, when people were moving towards smaller families. You didn't really hear about middle child syndrome when people had four, five, six kids routinely. Well, now the modal number of children, if you remember your statistics, modal number is the most common number. You know what the modal number of children is right now? One. Some of you are probably thinking two. And some of that's slanted because many people have a first child and they might have a second or third, but right now they only have one. So modal number is one. Most common number is two. Mothers get grief on this. Well, you've got your boy and a girl. Why are you trying for a third child? What are you doing? You're sucking up the rainforest. Given that, I think that middle child syndrome came about when you had stable, smaller families. In other words, there's a lot of families that have three kids. And that's considered a big number now. Oh, I watch these TV shows and these moms on these shows who have three children. Oh, they're just viewed as overloaded. They just can't deal with it. Now, you mothers of six, seven, eight, nine who are listening, you're snickering. Three? It's a walk in the park. But TV and the writers for TV, who generally tend to be childless, are looking at three kids like, what an overload! But that's when middle child kind of caught on. Because the three-kid family became stable. No more. You're not going to have a fourth. So that middle child in that spot speculated. Something is characteristic of these children. They don't have the privileges of the oldest. They don't get the attention of the youngest. They're kind of a lost child in the family structure. You want to have fun with middle child syndrome, go ahead. There's no such thing. And if you do say, well, my middle child is my most difficult, then that's what you're saying. It has nothing to do with being the middle child. It has everything to do with being that's who the kid is. No, I better get to the phones. 877-573-7825. That's the number. And I'm looking at a question right here that's going to get me in trouble. Definitely going to get me in trouble because this is one where you get a lot of people. If I'm going to get ugly emails, this could be it. Depending upon how I answer. 877-57-EQUAL. I'd love to hear from you. I'm Dr. Ray talking to you from Ave Maria University in Ave Maria, Florida.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jangle.
In St. Ignatius of Loyola's teaching on the discernment of spirits, St. Ignatius uses the phrase, the good spirit, to indicate God and the instruments of God's grace that move within the human heart to communicate his direction. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, the good spirit certainly indicates, above all, God in his direct action in the human heart. For Ignatius, good spirit also signifies the angels, who by God's design serve as instruments of his love for his children. The term the good spirit also indicates the many marvelous ways God communicates within our hearts through the life of grace, the gifts of the Holy Spirit, the influences for good in the world, and through the communion of saints. We too may also be called upon to be an instrument of grace in someone else's life. How will you open your heart and your day so that you may be an instrument of the good spirit?
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net. When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
I am so confused. I have a call from Gary, who is a female, a mom. But right after that, it says she's a pa. It says Jerry, female, pa. Oh, that's Pennsylvania, PA. Okay, I got it. I was all confused there. I didn't know. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Definitely not a pa.
Okay. No, you're identifying as a mom?
Yes, Grandma, Gigi.
Grandma, all right.
Gigi.
So I Gigi, that's a good grandma nickname, Gigi.
Isn't it? Especially
I think that's cute.
For my, thanks.
You got one of the kids who couldn't say grandma, so they kind of stumble around trying to find how to say grandma.
Yes, that's it. I'm a Gigi on one side and a Lala on the other side.
How in the heck did Lala come out of grandma?
Because there's a Gigi already on that side of the family, and I always wanted to be a Gigi. And so I had to think, well, what could I be that would my granddaughter would remember and would kind of identify me? Since I sing, I said, oh, I'll be Lala, and I'll sing to her all the time. La, 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 la.
So you already co-opted... The other side co-opted the name Gigi, and nobody can use it again now. That's it. Those kids got Gigi. If you got any other grandkids, you're going to be Lala or Mama or Moo Moo, or you're going to have to come up with some kind of repetitive little syllable thing.
Gigi Lala, Lala Gigi. It really should be Lala Gigi because I was a Lala before I was a Gigi.
I'm so confused. I was confused.
So in all fairness, I should be Lala Gigi.
When you were a pa here. Now, I got a feeling. You tell me if I'm wrong. If you're a grandma calling in with this question about six-month-old babies crying themselves to sleep, my guess would be that your daughter or your daughter-in-law is saying, no, I don't ever let them cry myself to sleep. And you, being of a more traditional child-rearing bent, would say, well, no, we did that, and the times the children just settled themselves down after a few minutes and went to sleep. Am I missing it, or is it reversed?
Actually, you're halfway there, because I babysit for my grandson, and my daughter is a wonderful mother, and she actually asks for my advice And I just keep saying, you just need to tune in to Dr. Ray, honey.
Wow.
He's got all the answers.
I got answers. I don't know if they're right, but I do have answers. Yeah, that's a fair statement.
So she's looking for guidance.
I will tell you this.
And I said, I'm going to call Dr. Ray. And is my son-in-law. They're both on the same page, both incredibly respectful and just wonderful to babysit. They make life really easy. And they work from home.
They can't, Gigi, they can't be that good of parents. They don't listen.
They are.
They aren't listening to me. So you can only go so high.
Well, exactly. Mm. But I told them also, I said, don't worry. I will find out the answer to this question.
Well, you know.
I will relay it to you. And
no, you won't.
I find it out. Will you then?
No, you won't. You know why you won't find the answer? Because I'll do like a typical psychologist and say, well, it kind of depends. But, all right, let me say the first thing. There are those listening to me that if I were to remotely even smell, like I'm saying, if the child is clean and dry and everything you can ascertain is okay, that this child is just getting to the point where they're becoming a little more aware that I just don't want to lay here without somebody, then I would get killed. They would say it'd be terrible, it'd be horrible. There is something called, I'm blanking. Forgive me. Eric, what's it called? Parenting. I'll think of it.
Leave the baby parenting syndrome?
No. You have any child who cries or is upset or distressed, you have to pick them up. You have to pick them up, okay? So given that, that's their philosophy, and they would say that anybody who lets a kid cry at 6 months, I don't want to say is evil incarnate, but is horridly, horridly misguided and may pay the price someday with a maladjusted child. I've heard this. All right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great overreactive stretch. So here's where I would come down on this. Your daughter, son-in-law, as you describe them, are great parents. And they're probably at the point, they got a number of kids, where they can read the signs as best you can. You can't know the distress of a kid if he's got some kind of stomach distress or something's bothering him. But if they notice, for example, by doing just a little bit of experimenting, that if they let this child lay in bed for certain times of sleep, and within 5 minutes the kids get to sleep, and this has happened 6, 8, 10, 12, 15, 20 times, well, they got pretty good evidence that, the child's getting to the point where he just needs to settle himself down. Okay? If they notice, this only happens rarely. Most of the time, the child falls asleep. But there are certain occasions when something's different. Then at that time, they can pick up that child and comfort him and cuddle him and settle him in their arms. And they're not going to spoil him. He's too young to be spoiled. Attachment parenting. That's what I was thinking of. Attachment parenting. Then that's okay. Pick them up. But if they're worried about if they do that, are they setting a precedent that now every time this child feels the sheets underneath his diaper, he's going to start fussing? Probably not.
That's what's
probably
happening.
Not. Well,
every time they
how long
him
is it
crib.
Before he falls asleep when they just simply allow him to settle himself?
They haven't been able to bear the length of crying past 15 minutes.
Okay. So they pick him up, what happens?
He stops immediately. They coddle him, you know, put him in his arms, and they rock him back to sleep, and they put him back down. Wakes up. Pick him back
asleep.
Up. And then...
Oh, he wakes up.
Four
oh.
Or five times.
Okay. At some point, then, I'm going to go out on a limb on that. I'm going to say at some point they're going to maybe have... Perhaps you have to go past the 15-minute mark. Because if you can't just keep picking him up and putting him down, picking him up and putting him down, picking him up and putting him down. That frustrates you. It tires you out. So I think when you said they can't bear it, I think they're worried about doing something psychologically wrong, Jerry. I don't... Jerry, I know I let you go because the hard break told me to shut up. However... I would like to revisit this with you a little bit. You don't have to call back, but But what I'll do is, in between calls here, or if the lines are quiet, I'll go back and flesh out a little bit of what I was saying here, because it is so dependent. And there are those folks who flat out say, never, ever, ever let a child cry themselves to sleep. That's what they would say. And they would say, not only is it breaking the parent-child bond, but it has reverberating ill effects psychologically, emotionally, and socially well into young and middle adulthood. Middle adulthood, is that kind of like middle child syndrome? That's really sketchy. However, the notion that this little guy will be spoiled, probably not. But I think a key factor is what you said at the very end, which is they comfort him and they set him down, which is cool, but he immediately wakes up. So they're doing a little experiment here. And the experiment is, for whatever the reason, he does not like being uncuddled or held. Now, if a parent says, that's okay with me, I'll cuddle, I'll pick him up, I'll cuddle him, I'll hug him, that's okay, he falls asleep, I'll put him down. After about the seventh time I do this, he falls asleep because he's exhausted. Or I fall asleep because I'm exhausted. And he's crying, but I can't hear him because I'm so tired, I'm deep in sleep. On the other hand, if they say, this seems to be a pattern here, and I'm going to see what I'm going to do about this, do a little experiment, and see after, for example, the third time I put him down, how long does he fuss? And what kind of fussing is it? They know whether it's a distressed fuss or a, I don't like this fuss. They probably can read if he's in any kind of gastric pain or something is bugging him. They've had other children, so they can read the cues. All right, let me go back to where Eric is there. Richard said, I broke the birth order rule. I don't know what the birth order rule is, but I'm going to find out how I broke it. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Dr. Ray.
Tell me what I did.
You've never heard of the birth order rule. That's amazing.
No, I haven't. Unless I have, but I didn't know it by that name.
Well, it's with families that are, you know, have adopted kids,
mm-hmm.
And you know, the typical family, the first child to arrive is the oldest, and then the second comes along, and they just maintain the order. But if you adopt, there's a chance, and not just a chance, you've described it, where the child you adopt is in the middle of the order or the first of the order. You know, they are now the oldest, and everybody else just moves right on down. And I was just wondering, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a good question, because you know we did that. We had our kids were 6, 5, 3, and 1. And we adopted 2 4-year-olds. What happened? Chaos. The 3-year-old felt very displaced. The 3-year-old was upset. The 1-year-old was oblivious. Okay, he didn't know anything about this. And the 6 and 5-year-old, my son was just kind of easy going, so he just kind of thought, okay, I got a brother and a sister. The 5-year-old daughter, she viewed it as, oh, good, 2 more siblings I can rule. But the 3-year-old, yeah, she got shook. She started biting, and there was definitely conflicts there. You know, at one point, she said this to the kids. She goes, "You're going back." She got in big trouble for that one. So you're right. There is a displacement. Although we didn't, even despite all that, Richard, we didn't see a permanent alteration in certain personality habits. We didn't. We saw a momentary adjustment that went on for probably, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 months, something like that, where our 3-year-old got a little more feisty, and we just had to deal with her behavior, that's all. And then ultimately she realized, hey, I got a couple brothers and sisters here, and the 4-year-old became her best friend, but it took a few months. So you're right. You can disrupt the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of a family by adopting a child. People will ask me, they'll say, should I adopt a child older than my oldest? And they'll say, well, I don't want to displace my oldest. And I said, well, I think the bigger concern is this. If you adopt an older child, there's a pretty good chance that that kid is going to have had a rough history. Obviously, if he's older, he's been in foster care. And if he's been in foster care, he was removed from a birth parent, either at birth or later through abuse or neglect. So it's likely that he's got more adjustment issues. It's likely he may be more immature, more impulsive, more worldly. If he's a 9-year-old and you've got a 6-year-old and you're adopting a 9-year-old who is far more worldly than your 6-year-old, that's risky. We did it when we adopted the twins because the 3 and the 1-year-old really weren't going to be all that influenced adversely by the 2 4-year-olds. They were behavior problems, but they were not worldly. So that's usually the caution I give parents. If they're going to adopt somebody older, be careful, because there's a pretty good chance this kid could bring into your household things that would cause behavior problems for your oldest, for example. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff, though.
Okay. But there's no clinical name other than...
No. No, there's no clinical name on it. All it really is that each situation kind of manifests itself differently. But I always tell parents, you be cautious about taking in, if innocence is really key to your child rearing, and you got a 6-year-old who's your oldest, and there's an available foster child who's 8, get to know as much of the history of that child as you can. For example, if that kid's been in foster care since he was a baby, and it was the same foster home, and the foster parents were just beautiful people who are on the same wavelength as you in child rearing, then there's a better chance that this kid isn't going to be any much more worldly than your 6-year-old. But if he's bounced around, or he has been drug and alcohol exposed in the womb, there's probably going to be some parenting issues there that you didn't deal with the other kids. There you go, Richard.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it so very much. Thank you, sir. 877-573-7825 is the number. It's halfway through, a little more than halfway through the program. We have line openings. So please, give me a call. I want to hear from you. You want to weigh in on this child birth order issue? Feel free. I can talk a little bit about the eldest child, because there is some support on that. But I'd rather hear from you. 877-57-EQUAL. Give me a call. We'll get you right up. Subliminal, that's what happened. Had certain calls, and they inspired similar calls, subliminal things. So this is apparently shaping up to be our Bedtime Bad Times program. Because Rochelle from Perrysburg, Ohio, which is the big nuclear plant there, right off the turnpike, I've been through Perrysburg many, many times, she says, now this is an interesting choice of words, I don't know if this is her word or Eric's word, 5-year-old granddaughter cannot, not won't, cannot sleep in her own bed, which means maybe the bed's too short, maybe it's too cold. Hi, Rochelle, how are you?
Hi, Dr. Ray. Thanks for taking my call. It's a privilege to talk with you.
Wow. Yeah, if I'd have known you were going to be that complimentary, I'd have taken you a lot quicker.
No, you're wonderful. So my daughter and her husband have a king size bed. My granddaughter's 5, and they bought her a bed, and she was sleeping in it for a good year. we went on vacation together about 2.5 years ago, and there was only so many bedrooms, so she was three at the time, almost three, and she slept in the middle between mom and dad on the king-size bed.
She liked that.
She loved it, and she will not. They've tried a lot of things. I'm not sure exactly what, but they're getting very frustrated because they need some bedtime by themselves too. So I don't know. I'm just wondering.
So they've let her sleep with them for 2.5 years.
Yes, they have. They have tried to put her in her bed, and I find some of the things they're like coaxing her to do, like, you know, we'll repaint your room the color you want if you sleep in your bed.
And I'll buy your red Corvette when you graduate.
Exactly.
Well, Ms. Rochelle, you're tapping into what parents get trapped into doing when you have a bedtime resistor. Probably a lot of it is, I'm scared, mommy, I'm scared. Mm-hmm. And then they worry, oh boy, am I messing my kid up? She's got a phobia. But then they realize, you know what? It's really hard to sort out how much of this is scare and how much of this is resistance. And most of the time, resistance takes over with the passage of time. However, even if it doesn't, even if there's a 50-50 component of fear and resistance, the way the fear is conquered is to make the child stay in her bed. Now, I'll bet you, Rochelle, if I talk to those parents, they would tell me all the ways that they tried to get her to stay in bed.
Okay.
And typically, okay, so they tried it, and that didn't work, so then she stayed in their bed for 2.5 weeks, and then they got frustrated again, and then they tried something else, and then they used a sticker chart, and that didn't work, so they let her stay in her bed for about a month, and then that didn't work, then they tried using M&Ms, and the M&Ms didn't work, okay, so they tried that. Then they took away her favorite privilege, and she didn't seem to care, because then she was right there, and then when they put her to bed, they had her all asleep, and then in the middle of the night, she showed up right next to their bed, and she wanted to get in her... Am I describing this...
Absolutely, to a T.
Yeah. Yep, I know. I was looking in their windows. Here's the problem most of the time. They haven't been anywhere close to firm enough.
Okay.
For example, when she comes and gets in their bed, they can tell her, you know, sweetheart, if you get in our bed and you don't stay in your own bed, tomorrow, pretty much every privilege you ask for is going to be no.
Okay.
Now, she won't believe that. What? Come on. I've been defeating them for 2.5 years. This is not going to happen. I'll defeat them. So tomorrow, when little Eve, is her name Eve or is it Dawn?
It's Emmy.
Oh, okay. You got that when I said Eve or Dawn. Did you get that a little bit, Rochelle?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Hated to have a name joke go to waste. Tomorrow, when they say, oh, no, you could have been able to go outside, but you didn't stay in your bed last night, so you can't go outside. Oh, no, you could have had your stuffed animal, but no, I put it on the refrigerator. You didn't stay in bed last night. Oh, gosh, no, you're going to have to sit on the steps for a little while because you didn't stay in bed last night. And then 2 hours later, oh, you know what, honey, you're going to have to sit back on the steps again because you didn't stay in bed last night. Once they do that about 2-3 days, it's over. She'll stay in her bed.
Oh, my gosh. How easy
she can't function if they don't say, if you stay in your bed, you'll get all your normal privileges. But if you don't, here's what we're going to do. Now, some might say, oh, that's overkill. Oh, my gosh, this poor kid. No, it's not overkill. She's been making bedtime bad time for 2.5 years. They're frustrated. Mm-hmm. They're angry. They're tired. They're not enjoying this. They're beating themselves to silly trying to figure out how to get her to stay in bed. She's totally strong-willed. No, she's not. Not any such thing. I've had 14-year-olds who are still sleeping next to their parents' bed.
Wow.
Because the parents never said, okay, this is done. My wife and I, of course, had 10 children. And they're all adopted, and some of them had some very bad histories. And they were much more prone to be resistant.
Okay.
My son, John, when we adopted him at age 4, had never been made to stay in bed. For 2.5 years, he roamed the foster parents' house. They couldn't get him to stay in bed. First night, Daddy made him stay in bed. And he never challenged it again after that.
Oh, my gosh.
One time. Because he read me. This guy means business. This guy's different. Oh, I didn't hurt him. I didn't yell at him. I didn't scream at him. I just held him in bed. He couldn't move. That's it. He said, Johnny, I'm not going to let you go, son, until I decide you're going to stay.
So
one time.
Just setting down that rule. And,
oh, absolutely.
Letting her know.
Yeah, they haven't done that. I'm almost positive they haven't done that.
Okay.
On the basis of hundreds of parents I've dealt with. And this puts the, what's the word I'm looking for? This puts the caution to those who say, let a child stay in your bed because ultimately they're going to want to go back to their own bed. That's not ever been my experience as a clinician. The average kid is not going to say at age 3.5, you know, I'm a little tired of coming to your bed. I think I need to sleep in my own bed. There are those who do that, but they're not the majority. The majority does what your little granddaughter does, which is, hey, I want to go there.
Yeah.
So, now, here's one other thing they can do. They can do this. Put her in bed, get her water, put the port-a-john beside there so she doesn't get to go to the bathroom 9 times, get the 650-watt floodlights illuminating the bedroom, put the 10 deadbolts on the closet door so the monster can't get out of the closet door. And then, as soon as she gets up, put her in the corner. Well, you're in the corner, honey. You're not tired enough to go to bed. You're in the corner. And leave her there for 5 or 10 minutes and then say, okay, you want to try your bed again? No. Well, okay, then just stay in the corner. And then you put her in bed, and she gets up. Oh, you're going to go back in the corner again. I'm telling you, once she reads that they're going to do this, it's over. She'll stay in her bed.
Okay.
And everybody will be happy, and you'll be a goddess. Don't tell them I told you this. Say, I listened to Garendi. He had no answers whatsoever. Here's what I decided. You tell him that.
Oh, darn.
Thank you, sweetheart, for the call. You take good care. Hey, call me back. In 2 weeks, if they do this, call me back. And let me know how it's gone so you can praise me up one side and down the other.
I sure will. I promise. Thank you.
Dear. Bye. See, that's the kind of stuff that gets me in trouble. People go, when I first listened to you, I didn't like you at all. I just thought you were so arrogant. Because I say things like, call me back so you can praise me up one side and down the other. I have my tongue in my cheek. I'll be back.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Blessed Carlo Acutis is quoted as saying, "Continuously ask your guardian angel for help. Your guardian angel has to become your best friend." We all have traveling companions, our guardian angels walking with us through life. How often are you communicating with your angel? Jesus said, "I send you an angel before you to protect you, to accompany you along the path so that you do not make mistakes." According to the tradition of the Catholic Church, each of us has a guardian angel who protects us and helps make us aware of things around us. In his Angels in 2021, Pope Francis noted that oftentimes we have that feeling that I should do this, or this is not right, or be careful. That's the voice of our guardian angel. We don't walk alone. Not listening to our guardian angel's advice, however, the Pope says, is like telling him to go away. It's dangerous to chase away our traveling companion. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
Marcus Peter hosts Unveiling the Covenant.
What is a covenant? It's a vowed exchange of lives which results in an unbreakable family bond. Throughout Scripture, God seeks to espouse all mankind to himself in an unbreakable covenant bond. His covenantal love is a free gift, but it necessitates a response from us. We are free to accept or reject it. Let's learn what this means as we unveil the covenants.
Saturday mornings at 11 and Sunday morning at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Yeah, this reminds me of when I was in high school, and they had these little sock hop dances, and I really was really too shy to ask any girls to dance or anything like that. So what I did is I sat over in my chair and I danced in my chair, trying to look cool, dancing in my chair. And then when they had the music, you know, like the Mamas and the Papas and the Turtles and those groups, you know, Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Chicago, I would mouth the words like I'm doing now. I go, and that's pretty much why I never had a single date. All right, Richard, you're being redundant here, three-year-old and stubborn. You are being redundant. Hi, Richard.
Well, sorry for the redundancy. I have four grandchildren, ages 6 to 8 months, and they're all four of them. Like, I won $1 billion in a lottery for each one of them. But the three-year-old, he just turned three, he was quite manageable at about 2 years and 5 months, 2 years, 6 months. And then more and more, he's manageable at all. He's very, very stubborn. The other kids were stubborn, but he just will not do anything you ask him to do unless he wants to do it. He just acts completely indifferent to it unless he wants to do it. So I'm sure it's fairly common.
Yes, it is, and you're bringing up several points that need to be addressed. The first one is that you describe the other three as not as, quote-unquote, I hate to use this word, willful. They're not as willful as he is. So they're looking at him thinking, oh, boy, well, we were great parents for the other three, but, man, this one's throwing us for a loop. No, this is just a kid who needs more parental confidence and firmness. More follow-through, more discipline, probably. That's the first thing. Second thing, he won't do anything he doesn't want to do when they ask him to do it. Well, by your description, where they're struggling is that they think they can just ask him to do something or not do something, and he's going to comply. It's not true. They're going to probably have to leverage about everything they'd say. For example, they ask him to do something, and he says no. Well, he's going to sit on the steps or stand in the corner because I'm going to decide when you're ready to do it. In other words, they can't just ask him using words because words just bounce off of him. Now, does that mean he's particularly stubborn? No, not at all. It just means that's who he is. And their parenting is going to have to rise up to dealing with him. I'll share with you an interesting thing. As I said, I have 10 children with some of them with pretty checkered histories. My wife, at one point all the kids were under 12. My wife never had defiance from the children, refusal to sit in time out or refusal to lay on their bed or refusal to go sit on the couch and read a book. Never. Because very early on she established she means what she says, and if you refuse, there's going to be multiple consequences. So the thing that taught me as a father, and I knew this as a psychologist, but it reinforced it as a father, is that most little kids, even your little three-year-old grandson, they will respond readily to discipline. And when they don't, it's because we parents aren't doing at the level we need to do. Might have been a good enough level for those other kids, but it's not a good enough level for this one. Okay. So he's going to spend more time on the steps, on the couch, on the corner, in the corner, because he doesn't easily cooperate. All right, I got that. So by the time he's 4 and a half, he'll learn mom and dad mean what they say, and I'm tired of spending time in the corner or on the steps. There you go. Did I overwhelm you with words and wisdom? Did we lose Richard? Supposed to be there? Lines blinking, potted up. I did overwhelm. I can overwhelm people with words a lot more easily than I can overwhelm with wisdom. You know, notice that. So, one final invitation. If you are anywhere near Ave Maria, Florida, and you want to come to be in the audience, Living Right with Dr. Ray tonight on campus. We're at the Student Center, I believe. But you can just ask anybody where it is, because we're doing some tapings at 5:30, 7:15 are the tapings there. You don't have to sign up now. It's we've got plenty of seats. We filled up most of them, but we can always put more chairs up if we have to. Last night we had some real nice size audiences, and it was wonderful. And a lot of the kids came. They were forced to come because they got extra credit, and they had to. I had one girl come. She said she'd come anyway. That was one person, yeah. And she's obviously the valedictorian. So, inviting you there tonight, and I know I'm getting real close to the end. I don't have my clock with me because I'm sitting in a studio not made for radio. But I don't have a clock other than my phone, and Andrew just told me 30 seconds. Good enough. Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. Thanks, Andrew Krucek, producer man, and Eric Dumont, call screamer man, and all the grandparents who called. Notice that? The theme? All grandparents, all grandkids, all under five. Wow. All right. Walk with God, always.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRRay.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.